Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Welcome to the America Magazine podcast, the week of February 21st. We are doing our annual Oscar podcast, and we're very happy to be joined by Bill McGarvey and Jim Martin. Welcome, Bill.
Hey, thanks for having me. Fourth year in a row?
Fourth year in a row, yes. Bill, formerly of Busted Halo, and Jim, our culture editor. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you very much. Good to be down from the ninth floor.
Now, since we have 10 films, and we've worked hard to see as many of these as we could.
I know we
got some guff last year.
We did.
We didn't see all
of
them.
You got guff? Really?
We did. Someone wrote in and said, your last podcast, only half of you saw half of the movies. We canceled that person.
So I think we've all seen at least 8 of them.
Yes.
So that's.
But I think all of us have seen one of them.
Right? Yes, exactly. Yeah. So there won't be no dead spaces.
A lacunae.
Okay, well, let's launch right in. Black Swan is the first on the list, so... Bill, you said that you were just saying before we started recording, you're a little disturbed by this film.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a. What did I see? David Edelstein had a great review. People were getting
from New York Magazine, right?
From New York Magazine, said, you know, I think it wasn't a great movie. He thought it was a very well done dumb movie, which I thought was an interesting comment. I liked it, but I was saying to you before, incredibly disturbing movie. And when I saw it, I mean, look, Natalie Portman did a beautiful job, and I thought, you know, some of the special effects. As minimal as they were, it was powerful. It was a very psychotic, you know, kind of mind twist movie. But I enjoyed it. But it's certainly not from the doldrums of winter when you're caked with snow. It was not an uplifting movie. But not, they don't have to all be Toy Story.
Right, exactly.
I thought it was a good movie. But it would not be a choice for me for Best Picture. But Natalie Portman is clearly the front runner.
Yeah, she's going to win.
Actress.
Father Jim, what was your take on it?
I thought it was great. I think she is going to win Best Actress. Such an unusual role. I think it is an odd picture. I remember the fellow I saw it with, another Jesuit. I turned to him afterwards and I said, I feel like I just had a nervous breakdown.
Exactly.
But I thought, you know, for me, it was almost a kind of parable or almost a kind of operatic way of looking at things. Mm-hmm. You know, like a ballet or an opera, it was very fantastical. It was very surreal. I have to say, without giving away the ending, which I won't, I thought it led up to a very beautiful and unusual and provocative ending, you know, when you compare it to the actual, you know, swan-like ballet.
Right.
So I thought it was a great portrait of a person who's, you know, gradually going into insanity. So I think in a sense it was, you know, almost like some of the other Darren Aronofsky stuff, you know, like Pi and things like that, that I think, you know, tried to portray this sort of unusual emotional, mental, and psychological state. And I thought it did it very well. I mean, I don't think it's meant to be taken. I know you're not, as like a sort of a documentary type thing. So for what it was, I found it very powerful and quite creative. And I thought the only problem with me for me was that it was so intense. There's no scene where Natalie Portman or any of the other actors relax. And so it was this kind of this fever pitch for an hour and a half, which I found kind of draining. But I really enjoyed it in the end.
It almost felt like a Hitchcock Psycho.
Yeah,
you know, I think that's what he was going for. I didn't think it was entirely successful. That was my take.
Right.
I reviewed it for America's website. I saw it with the preview audience, and it's funny. Maybe it was because that built up kind of anxiety. There were scenes at the end, like when her foot grows into like ogre proportions, you know, mm-hmm. it grows huge, and mm-hmm. people just burst out laughing.
Mm-hmm. Did they really?
Yeah, in the preview audience. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe it was just everything was built up, and mm-hmm. so my experience was colored by that. I thought, well, this isn't supposed to be funny, but yet,
right.
you know, people are laughing. I didn't think the descent into psychosis was entirely successful. I did think it explored an interesting notion, like here was a woman trying to attain perfection, and
right.
you know, she may be able to do it on the stage, but her whole life just kind of unravels as a result. So.
Yeah, I guess I give it a lot of leeway because if you're looking at the world through her eyes, her
right.
kind of crazy eyes, that sort of, I gave it a little sort of
sure,
pass.
I understand.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was it was tiring watching it. I was exhausted at the end.
I think we should warn our readers that our listeners that coming from coming from a long line of obsessive compulsive Irish Catholics, we need to be careful about who we send this movie to. Send
right.
this movie because it really plays.
Right.
It's a really I'm teasing, but it is all about compulsive obsession
yeah.
and perfection,
right.
and, which is actually I felt. In some ways, a very faith-related thing, this notion of perfection, which in
sure.
certainly growing up in some ways, I kind of...
Pelagianism.
Sort of that sense of, I can perfect myself. I
right.
can be perfect.
Right.
What is perfect?
Well, this is, you read my review. I bring this up.
Tim, I don't read your reviews. I don't want to taint my own opinion with...
Well, let's speaking of Irish Catholics, let's transition to
yeah.
The Fighter, which I have not seen, but Bill has seen. I think you're the only one, so...
Yeah, we can interview you.
We're going to ask you about
it. Oh, then I'm the only one that... I saw everything but one.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well,
so,
go ahead.
Yeah, I thought The Fighter was... I thought there were some really moving parts to it. To mention the Irish Catholic, and I don't want to overstate that too much, it is a very tribal story of this Irish Catholic family in Western Massachusetts, I believe.
In Lowell, Massachusetts.
I think Mark Wahlberg did a good job. I think Christian Bale did a really good job, a great job. And Melissa Leo as the mother was... When I saw her on an award show, I was like, that's the same woman that played the mother? I mean, she really transformed herself. I thought it was a powerful movie. I thought there was some... I had some problems, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen it, but I thought there was some sort of narrative arc issues that sort of got in the way of me buying some of the transformation that happened. But that all said, it's a very powerful story. In many ways, I mean, we were doing this for America Magazine, deeply Catholic roots to a lot of it, you know. And
are they overtly Catholic in the movie?
Wahlberg himself is obviously very Catholic. I think he goes to daily mass in real life.
In the movie,
he prays. He gets on his knees and he blesses himself. And I'm just trying to think if there was a priest in the movie. I don't think there was, actually. But they were definitely this tribal West Lowell, Massachusetts clan. But a powerful, you know, story of family. It was prodigal son type stuff. It was powerful. A very good movie, but not my choice for best movie, but a powerful movie, absolutely.
Did you think one of the critiques I'd heard with that was that the women are portrayed as, you know, more or less sort of screaming harpies?
Shrews, harpies.
Are there sympathetic? I mean, there's Amy Adams. Is there a sympathetic female character in it?
Oh, Amy Adams is tough. Yeah. But I hadn't seen that particular critique then because. Yeah, I would say everybody in the movie is insane. Insane, but it is really extreme, hardcore people that are living, you know, pretty close to the edge.
Right.
So there's not a lot of emotional health in this world. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is, the Wahlberg character in real life is this. Irish Mickey Ward is really trying to opt out of what is sort of like, you know, this is my family and I love them, but they're crazy too, and this is not working, and I need, and this love of the Amy Adams character is his potential wife, becomes this sort of his ability to see beyond his tribe without sort of leaving his tribe, you know. So it was kind of, in that sense, it was there were some beautiful moments to it. I think that'll be hard to put because I think everybody in that movie, men and women, We're really pushed to the edge. So
none of them should go to see Black Swan either.
Men and women should probably not see this movie.
Right, not a good double feature. Well, speaking of a movie that's going to make your head hurt, we've got Inception from Christopher Nolan, which I recently watched on demand. I think I have to watch this film a second time to figure out what
I think I have to watch it on a widescreen. I saw it on TV, and from what I hear from people that saw it in the theater, it's just, you know, it's mind-blowing. And I found it was interesting, but go ahead, you were going to talk about it.
Well, I was just saying that it is one of these films where, you know, this is the guy who created Memento and then, of course, went on to make Dark Knight. And it is kind of Memento-esque in that he has these layers within layers, worlds within worlds that he introduces to the reader. And, you know, if you're not paying attention, you can kind of lose track. But there are certain people who were blown away by this film. Bill, what camp are you falling into?
Not blown away, but I thought a very good filmmaker. It's funny, it was over the summer and I had a bunch of interns working with me and we asked them to go see it. And it was interesting
that
to
was
see.
A good idea.
It was interesting to see from a younger person's perspective, somebody 21, 19, 20. A lot of them were, because for those of you who haven't seen it, it is Christopher Nolan. If you saw The Dark Knight, which I had to see three times, which I really loved, but he deals in so many layers, you know, that you have to go watch the thing multiple times, which I think can ultimately be a deficit for a film if it is so taxing that I have to get through it. And I think that would be my critique of Inception. But I thought it was powerful to see these younger people who were also deeply on their own faith journey seeing Inception as this sort of almost religious moment where when I watched the film, as much as technically it's brilliant and it's really powerful, and you're right, Jim, on a big screen, Father Jim, but I kept, because there are these, for those who haven't seen it yet, there are multiple layers of reality, and going deeper and deeper into dream states. And I kept feeling like this is one of the toxic things that we have in our culture sometimes is where we escape into deeper levels. And I felt like saying, yeah, I'll give you reality. Give me a knife and I'm going to cut your skin right now. Mm-hmm. You're going to see yourself bleed. That is pain. That's real. That's incarnate pain and suffering. And so as much as I think he's a great filmmaker and a very, you know, again, technically beautiful in many ways, mm-hmm. I kind of felt like I want to punch through or break through all these layers.
I also felt there were too many layers. I mean, I think the idea of sort of getting into someone's dreams and, you know, as most people know, and sort of extracting something, that was the idea they were trying to do. You know, the idea that they were going dreams within dreams within dreams, yeah. I kind of thought in the end it was almost like he was trying to set up a goal for himself or some sort of hurdle and limit, you know, how crazy and how kind of complicated right. can we get? To the point where, you know, towards the end of the movie, I thought, all right, now where are we? What dream are we in? And I think if he had just gone down that exactly. one level, that would have been enough. You know? And I thought it's sort of, he sacrificed a little bit of the emotional heft for this kind of gimmickry.
And it's just dawned on me, and he's a great example, Memento, which is another, was a brilliant movie. But again, like some other directors out there, they're so smart, it gets in their way of ability to ever touch you emotionally at all. And I think I think for all of his intelligence, and there's a love story at the core
there
of Inception,
is, you know,
and you never quite get.
And you know what? And I didn't really care.
I
wasn't really invested in that.
Yeah.
You know,
I think because there's so much intellect, your brain is going so fast that it's hard to get to me. I agree that it.
Well, and as Tim says, if you blink for 1 minute, you know, I mean, you're lost.
You have to take a note. Like, where were we? Literally, so, I mean, again, a very proficient, great filmmaker, but I always leave, like, they don't stay with me. It didn't stay with me.
Well, I'm sure we'll have some disagreement among some of our listeners because he's got some big fans out there.
Oh, sure.
We'll switch now to The Kids Are All Right. This is one of two independent films. I think this was in Sundance as well as Winter's Bone. This is The Kids Are All Right with Julianne Moore and Annette Bening. I just watched this on DVD again recently. I was really taking it with it first. I thought it fell a little flat at the end. But it was a kind of story where you're not sure how to end it. But Father Jim, why don't you weigh in?
Yeah, I mean, it's about for people that haven't seen it, it's about a lesbian couple and their children who go to find their birth father, who turns out to be Mark Ruffalo, who I think is one of my favorite actors. He's just terrific in everything. I thought Annette Bening was a standout. Julianne Moore was excellent in this. I did think it lost a little steam towards the end. I thought the ending wasn't, I don't want to give it away again. I thought it was an interesting portrayal of sort of a, you know, 21st century family. You know, it was kind of realistic in that way. And I thought that the fact that they didn't, you know, make their lesbian relationship the sort of focus of the movie, it was more about the family, the children, and in a sense, a sort of their search for themselves. I was very impressed with Annette Bening. I also think this is kind of facile, I think, but she's one of the few actresses that are not using Botox. And she has a face that looks however old she is, 50, 55. Mm-hmm. And she just looks like a real person. And I think that actually contributed to the movie for me. This is a person who looks sort of, you know, her skin is kind of lived in and she looks lived in. And I thought the acting was good all around. But as Tim said, I think you're right. I think that's a good way of saying it. I don't think they knew where to go at the end. And it just sort of stops. And I didn't think it was sort of satisfying emotionally.
Well, because they introduced this relationship of the biological father. Mm-hmm. And at first, they seem to hit it off with the kids.
Right.
You know, he's kind of hip. It's a little over the top.
Yeah, he's a little too hip. Right?
A little too cool
motorcycle.
For school
at
points. Yeah. But you wonder, okay, how is this going to end with any kind of meaningful relationship? And it just kind of ends, and there's also a love relationship between Mark Ruffalo and one of the women.
Yeah, that's the part. I also thought that was a little, it just seemed odd to me, and sort of thrown in just to sort of. It seems to me to kind of appeal to mainstream audiences. You know?
Right. One thing I did like, they didn't portray this lesbian couple as saints. You know, they were.
Right.
It was a real partnership with all the, you know, the flaws that come with it. The Annette Bening character is kind of controlling and you know, not very attractive as a person.
Yeah.
At least in some aspects. So, I mean, it was a realistic look at that kind of family life.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. I kind of agree. Mark Ruffalo is one of my favorite actors, and I recently rewatched that movie. And it's funny. I watched it with a number of Jesuit friends. I saw it first with a Jesuit friend of mine, and then when I recently rewatched it, it was with a bunch of friends, some of whom were Jesuit. We were watching it again, and I have to say that I had going into seeing the movie the first time a lot of prejudice about the movie because I thought. When I saw the previews, because I go to a lot of movies, I remember thinking, this is going to be Hollywood's take on, you know, same-sex couple, and it's going to be like...
like an advertisement
an
for
an after-school special
marriage.
Or
yeah.
something, almost.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be trite. And I have to say that after I saw it, it doesn't matter that the same-sex... It becomes... that becomes almost an invisible dynamic to a certain degree. It's a family that loves each other and is struggling mightily against some real stuff. And I think that love story came through really well. And my point was only, when I initially saw the previews, I thought this is going to be gimmicky and I'm not going to like it. And pretty soon into it, it was like, no, this is better than I thought. It's not.
It's funny you should say the previews were very sort of cutesy and funny and upbeat. And for me, it was more about the kids. You know, the kids sort of search for, in this very complicated family they come from, search for their own sort of self, you know, and who are they? So I don't think she's going to get Best Actress. I think Natalie Portman's going to walk away. But I thought she was terrific.
She was great. Benning. And that daughter, whoever the daughter she is, she was in Treatment on HBO. I forget her name. Good. She's great. Yeah. She's got this pained expression, but she's great. And Ruffalo does do a great job. And I just thought it was a really beautifully nuanced character portrayal where you cared about this family, and it did not become a stereotypical gimmick of the lesbian couple and the hipster dad. It could have easily gone. Yeah. But the ending didn't bother me as much. I liked the ending. I thought it was, I mean, it wasn't neat and tidy, but I thought it was...
In that sense, realistic then.
Yeah. I thought it was actually reasonable.
It was funny. He was very much like the character in You Can Count on Me, one of my favorite movies with Laura Linney. And he's this kind of dude and, you know, pretty cool and a little feckless, too, you know, both of the movies.
Totally. But,
so it was interesting to see. It's almost like that character 10 years later.
That's very true. Yeah. No, he's good. Ruffalo's really
The only
good.
One other issue I think it deals with fairly well is, and I think this is going to become an issue more and more these days as more children are conceived this way, whether through a lesbian couple, a gay couple, or a straight couple, is this kind of yearning for a sense of identity and knowing. I mean, this is something, the children of adoption have known for a long time, but these children of these kind of assisted fertility, it's going to be an issue. So I think this is something that will be explored in pop culture in various ways.
Well, and it also shows that it's not, people, couples like that who can see that way, there are problems down the road.
Yeah,
you know? It's not like all pie in the sky.
Exactly. Whether they're problems or not, you have to be realistic about what options
it is certainly
come to the surface. Yeah, exactly.
That's a great point. Yeah. And Tim, I think you make a great point about these stories of adoption, especially with surrogate parenting and all these things. You're right. There are going to be a lot of issues where children understand what the church talks about. I mean, they want to know who they are, where they come from, and there are going to be identity issues.
So this is almost like the first major one kind of treatment of
it. I think you're right.
Well, let's switch to The King's Speech, which is right now in the lead to pick up the Best Picture Oscar. I guess the question that some people have posed is that what makes this the best film of the year and not, Father Jim, a really good masterpiece theater special?
Well, what makes it the best picture of the year is that it's about royalty. It's about something overcoming a physical obstacle, and it has Colin Firth in it and Helen Bonham Carter. I think it's the sort of catnip to the Academy. That's the kind of stuff that they like. I do think, though, I mean, all kidding aside, I thought that the performances were terrific. The performances were they have it's standout cast. I thought Colin Firth, just in his stammer, was amazing, and you can feel his sort of passion. I thought Jeffrey Rush was beautifully done, and I thought Helena Bonham Carter was this beautiful portrayal of Queen Elizabeth and her compassion. And in a sense, it's a little bit of a love story. It's a love story between Elizabeth and King George, which you don't see very much, in terms of the royals. They're usually put up as almost like a period pieces. I used to think that The Social Network was going to win because I thought that was a brilliant movie. But I think that this is the kind of movie that people look to. It's a quote-unquote serious movie, and it also has a wide appeal. Yeah. But I also think Colin Firth will probably win. He won in the BAFTAs the other night.
Did he?
Mm-hmm.
I agree. I actually really did love this movie, and it is one of those things. You're right. It is catnip, I think, to the Academy voters. But that's just why is it? Because it's a very powerful story, and it's well done. It could have easily moved into some really dangerously, cliched hack territory, didn't. It's funny you mentioned Colin Firth because the person I come away with, Jeffrey Rush, his character, his face, his ability to embody this Australian emigre in the early part of the 20th century, living in this basement flat, and then where the King George comes, sort of surreptitiously to meet and get therapy, and just what they go through. And that really, that it's an ancient story of, the commoner coming in touch with royalty and the friendship and love and brotherhood and help and, that comes from that. And I was less in, Helena Bonham Carter did a fine job, but that relationship between the two of those people, and I think everyone who just sees what the royal family went through, you're right, the notion of somebody stammering like that. We've all known people in our lives who dealt with that horrible, that very difficult issue of stuttering. And it's just a triumphant, very optimistic story that it was got a historical base. Of course, I went right home and looked it up. Looked up how true the story was.
I was like my knight on Wikipedia.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
absolutely. And it apparently is very close. I know Christopher Hitchens has come. Has really slammed it, but I really think it misses the point. Just to fill in quickly, that King George and his brother clearly were more interested in appeasing. I think his brother was far more.
The brother was
a fan of Hitler.
Oh yeah.
King George, I don't think that ever was a problem. I mean, he was, but appeasement was certainly something he favored more, I believe, right?
The brother, the Duke of Windsor, I mean, was much more of a...
But even, this is the controversy that's since come out, that even George himself was more in favor of appeasement than, say, Churchill, of course.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What did you think of the movie, Tim?
Oh, I thought it was excellent. I mean, by the time I'd seen it, I'd read every review and seen every advert, so I feel like, you know, it was very enjoyable. And I agree, the scenes between Rush and Firth, that's, for me, what makes it rise to the next level. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are two pros in the ring, you know, just... duking it out. It just was really good.
And also not portraying the king as a perfect, you know, this kind of avatar of, you know, this kind of, you know, sound like he's a St. Louis or something. But he was very prickly, you know. But I thought some of the scenes between Helen Bonham Carter and Colin Firth, where he's crying and saying, I can't do this, I thought they were really beautiful and touching and sort of universal. I was surprised how moved I was by that movie. I didn't expect that. I thought it would be like watching... You know, Downton Abbey or Masterpiece Theater, but it was moving, and you see this guy sort of triumph. One of the funny stories I heard, though, was in a review that said that, you know, you're so happy at the end, you know, and you realize that England is being invaded. You know,
that's a great.
I mean, that, you know, you're so delighted that World War II has come. It's kind of a strange emotional thing.
But to put it against, I mean, let's face it. In my mind, World War II is the most monumental world event in the past 150 years. And the backdrop of being World War II and this man who, I was thinking, Jim saying that made me think of The Fighter and its own little family tribe and the dynamics, the dysfunction in the royal family. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to be king, and he was deeply embarrassed with this, and the family was as well, to overcome that. And then to lead the nation, which a lot of people have forgotten, how the royal family stayed in London during the Blitz, right? Which was a very everybody thought they should have left.
Right.
A deeply moving and symbolic act of solidarity with their people.
Well, you know that famous quote, they said, will the children leave? You know, Elizabeth Margaret leave? And she said, the quote from the Queen Mother was, the children won't leave if I don't leave and can be with them, and I will not leave if the king does not leave, and the king will never leave.
Good.
So it's very moving.
That's very moving.
It is moving. And the other thing I think was interesting sort of historically is that you know, the Queen Mother, Queen Elizabeth, and the current queen really were always angry at the Duke of Windsor, Edward, you know, for abdicating and sort of forcing that role on the father, you know, who died. I thought another interesting thing was, you know, that, you know, he dies of cancer, you know, later on, and that scene where he's saying, you know, that my doctor said keep smoking. That's how he dies.
Right.
Oh, he dies of cancer?
Lung cancer.
No,
in the 50s.
The Queen Mum died very old. She
was 100 just a few years ago.
5 years ago or something, The next film, I know Bill and Father Jim are both fans of Danny Boyle. So maybe you can talk about, you know, the famous arm-severing movie. What was your take on it?
127 Hours. I have to say that, you know, I'm a big, as we all are, fans of movies, but Danny Boyle is in the best kind of way, an optimistic soul as a director. I mean that because that could easily become just cliche, and he's not. He did Millions, which is just a beautiful movie. It always, when I've seen, I own it. He did Slumdog Millionaire, which I remember loving. I saw it only once, but it could easily move into some really horrible territory, and he doesn't. He somehow knows people and has great love for his characters. And 127 Hours is the story of, I forget the gentleman's name, but
Aaron Rothstein, I believe.
He goes off into the Arizona, the desert somewhere.
Utah desert,
and falls in a ravine and has his arm stuck for 127 hours. And eventually, I don't think I'm telling anybody anything new, but has to sever his own arm to save himself.
Oh, no, you ruined it for me.
Oh, my gosh, why see
that's
it?
Right. Doesn't he become king, though, and have to do his speech?
He becomes king, and then he abdicates for Wallace Simpson. It's strange.
I give my right arm for Wallace Simpson.
Anyway, there is a brutal scene, as you can imagine, not necessarily gory, but Danny Boyle, in a filmic way, deals with that horrendous act that he has to do upon himself. But it's actually ultimately incredibly redemptive because he saves his own life through this act. But what's brilliant about it is because it is almost like a play. It's really one man in the whole talking to himself. And in that sense, it's a moving movie. It's very worth seeing. I'm not sure I want to see it again only because it is so harrowing when they get to that really very difficult place. But it's it's ultimately worth seeing. I think only, and again, Danny Boyle, I just it, there's it's so easy to for me for a lot of people to adopt a posture of, you know, like Sofia Coppola's movie Somewhere this year. I came out of that just very frustrated, like feeling like, you know, this sense of existential angst feels is beginning to feel like a very tired pose or posture and kind of shorthand. Whereas Danny Boyle is able to articulate something else entirely, and it doesn't feel again cheap.
Now you liked it. I didn't see it. I couldn't bring myself to see it.
Yes, I very much liked it. I
remember
I
you.
Your
review was very good, and you started off with the sort of scene.
The scene, yes, the famous
the
scene.
De resistance.
Well, what I was amazed by at the end, as Bill said, is the optimism. Is that, and I think this film, more than any other of Boyle's films, kind of crystallized his kind of aesthetic. And that one is that he's kind of fascinated in a weird fetishistic way with like body fluids. And I mean, you talk about, you know, the going back to Train Spotting where the guy's swimming through the feces.
Well, also in Slumdog Millionaire. Yeah.
So there's something about, but it's he finds a certain joy in it because it's like a sign of life, you know, whether it's urine or, in this movie, it's blood, you know, blood and more blood.
Great point.
So there's that element of it. But also, you know, you talk about Millions, which is about a kid who kind of encounters saints in his everyday life. In this movie, the realization that the character comes from is one who's very much kind of an individual who does, you know, kind of has broken up his relationship with his girlfriend, doesn't call his parents, living alone. Then he goes out in the wilderness, doesn't tell anybody he's going anywhere. So he's really trying to cut himself entirely off from community. And what he realizes during the course of this ordeal is that he can't do that, is that he has to in some way be part of a community. So that he kind of comes to realize, I think, you know, also in Saints, in Millions, to see this is that he is part of kind of a larger community. You know?
Well, I was thinking, you know, in, as you were talking, I was thinking in Millions. Remember the father and the father moves the kids away to a brand new neighborhood,
right.
And they're sort of apart from the community. And the kid finds community in the communion of saints, which is that's an interesting. The part about bodily fluids, that's very that's very interesting.
That's my unique perspective.
No, that's very interesting because I mean that scene in Slumdog Millionaire where the guy like just jumps
right.
into
the feces,
into the latrine. Yeah. That's a great. I never thought about it. I'm a huge fan of Danny Boyle. I think you're right, Tim. It made me think honestly of, and I can say this on American Magazine's pod, like it's not Eucharistic, but there's an enfleshed sense of matter.
Yeah, exactly.
Matter.
Exactly.
Well, also, my body given up for you,
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that we don't discount any of this.
Right.
And we're going to take you to places that you're very uncomfortable
with. Right.
But you have to deal with the body.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
We are not ethereal beings. We
exactly.
are bodily.
That this is part of who
I
we are.
I never thought of that. That's a great
no
point.
No Cartesian dualism for Danny Boyle.
Danny Boyle's not into that. No, I agree. That's a great way of putting it. But anyway, not for the faint of heart. I definitely will not be seeing
not
it
for,
again.
Not,
but
for,
it was
the,
very
not
good.
For America's culture. That's why I sent Tim Reedy out to review it.
Well, let's switch to the other big, I would say the other major contender, The Social Network. Jim, you said you thought this was your favorite of the bunch.
I think this is, you know, I have to say, I thought this film was brilliant. I am a huge fan of David Fincher. I'm, you know, I think Zodiac was one of the great sort of underrated movies in the last 10, 15 years. I think his palette is really interesting, that kind of dark palette. For me, I thought what was fascinating was the sort of dark palette of David Fincher, the director, and this kind of bright, poppy, quippy world of Aaron Sorkin, the two of them kind of coming together. I thought the writing was terrific. I thought Jesse Eisenberg was fantastic, you know, this kind of almost comatose, you know, sort of just sort of semi-conscious guy, and yet who, in terms of, you know, his emotional IQ, and yet who's, you know, completely brilliant and is obsessed with success. I thought it was a great meditation on sin. I thought it was a terrific meditation on...
Really?
Yes, because of his own selfishness and the way he sort of betrays people and lies and cuts himself off to the point where you see how it affects people and how it sort of destroys lives. So I thought he was, in a sense, amoral in the movie, and you get a sense of this kind of effect of sin. He's not the real Mark Zuckerberg, but I read about, you know, him. The Mark Zuckerberg, in quotes, the character, is amoral, you know, and he will do anything to sort of slide over people. That scene in the deposition where, you know, his friend, his former friend, who I thought Andrew Garfield did a great job, cannot even face him because he's been betrayed, I thought was terrific, and it was almost like a... I thought it was almost like a Jesus Judas moment, you know.
But totally, so, that's a great. I mean, the way you just described it, it makes perfect sense in that. But I mean, to me, the tough thing about Zuckerberg, he's a cipher. At least the way he's portrayed in the movie, he is a moral zero, almost dysfunctional.
I'd say amoral.
Amoral.
I mean, I would say he has no moral. He knows no moral. He might be immoral. I would say. You
know? Because I almost felt there was either he is disabled in terms of the ability to affectively, emotionally engage with a human and to understand. You're right. What his friend says, how did you do this to a friend?
Yeah.
That is, to me, the ultimate betrayal.
But I would say, I think emotionally he's a cipher. I mean, he has this very flat affect, but yeah. But morally he's negative. I mean, morally he is immoral. He has this, that you can say that this is an immoral guy who's making these unhealthy choices and these sort of mean-spirited choices, you know, against his friends. I also thought the only thing that bothered me a little bit, and Tim, you saw it, of course, right?
I did, yes.
I do want to say, I thought that the dialogue, and this is one of my complaints about Aaron Sorkin, the dialogue was a little too perfect. I mean,
a little too
polished. It was sort of like The West Wing. I mean, not everybody speaks in these perfect sort of, you know, Oscar Wildean sentences, you know, and so.
I will also I'll let Tim start in a sec, but just real quick,
ahead.
I do think that at a certain point, I guess I'm a little bit over Jesse Eisenberg and the whole Jesse. I mean, I think he's a very talented actor, but I've seen him do a similar kind of role numerous times.
Yeah, it's interesting.
But I also, I completely lost my train of thought. sorry,
okay.
Tim, you go ahead. Maybe it'll come back to me.
It's funny. We've talked about this before, is how different audiences react to this film.
Yes,
and there's certain older audiences, I think, definitely see this guy as amoral, somebody who's kind of leaping over his friends in order to basically sacrificing them to succeed. Others, young people, say, well, he did what he needed to do.
Right.
I mean, he succeeded and he accomplished something. So,
which is kind of terrifying when you think about it. It's like steamrolling right over somebody.
Thank you for reminding me, because that's exactly what happened. After a buddy of mine called me, he goes, wasn't that awesome?
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, it was a good movie. He goes, oh, wasn't it awesome when they ask him, why aren't you paying attention during the deposition? He says, I'm busy thinking up ideas that the Winklevoss could ever even fathom. And this friend of mine, and a couple of friends of mine, had sort of said they thought that was a real great American story. This guy.
I mean, that is true. I mean, that is, you know, I mean, you look at some of the robber barons, and they do have that spirit, but it's so arrogant and so prideful.
Yeah.
And the irony is, you know, he gets his comeuppance in the movie. You know, in real life, he's, you know, this fabulously wealthy, apparently happy billionaire who always had a girlfriend. That was the thing about the real life that really kind of surprised me, that, you know, one of the conceits of the movie is that he has no girlfriend.
Right,
he's trying to get, you know, and then I read an article in Vanity Fair. Oh, yeah, I've had a girlfriend the whole time, you know, so.
But
anyway.
That said, the New Yorker profile I thought was interesting, because reading between the lines of a lot of these things is you get the sense, sadly, and Zuckerberg has been very proactive in his camp. Doing a PR campaign.
Yeah, like giving $10 million the week the movie came out.
$100 million to the Newark.
Which I thought was the worst timing ever. So obvious.
And I think there's a certain, I still think, sadly, I think he's a young man who's very, very bright. I sadly think that there is sort of this moral obtuseness, maybe, or sort of just a personal obtuseness. I hate to convict him of that, but I do think there's a sort of like, almost like a moral formation that we're not able to sort of find common ground on to talk about these things. Like, wow, what you did to your friend was just wrong.
Well, and you know, if he stole it, he stole it. I mean, there's the Winklevoy, which I thought was kind of funny, Winklevi, the way that they are the Winklevi, they're referred to in the movie. They're still suing, you know, and they still want their sort of credit.
It's worth $50 billion.
Yeah, right.
When I saw this,
maybe we should sue too at American Magazine.
Father Jim's alma mater. I saw it at a theater down by Penn.
Okay, go
Quakers. And I remember thinking, I'm seeing it sitting here with all these Penn.
All these Wharton types.
And they're all watching these Harvard type of bits. They're all sitting there angry. You know, it just was interesting to see it in that environment. It was packed house. But it was a good movie. I don't think I could say it was anywhere near as good. I
thought it was much more creative and innovative than The King's Speech. I mean, The King's Speech I thought was a better movie, but in terms of just pushing the boundaries cinematically and dialogue and sort of framing, the cinematography was different. I thought it was more creative and sort of forward thinking. And it dealt with a whole different, you know, a whole new concept.
And I think it's dealing with something that everybody is not sure what to think about, which is social media and how our social landscape has been totally transformed so quickly.
Yeah.
That's what comes across from this film, is that this happened over the course of like 6 months.
Right.
And you see what's happened, and that like there are 500 million people on
Facebook. And in that sense, I thought it was more daring. I mean, The King's Speech could have been made 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
You know, Social Network could not have been.
Right.
No, and I think I agree with that completely, and I think in that sense it's very current. I think maybe too current for us to be able to have any perspective on it.
Right.
But what it makes me all think is that whoever developed Twitter better watch their back.
That's right.
You know, because
don't steal it.
Right. Now we've got Toy Story 3, which a lot of people thought was the best picture of the year, and our reviewer, John Anderson, was very high on it. Maybe, Jim, you can introduce the movie and then the review.
Sure. Well, it's far too gory for me, so I couldn't bring myself to see it. You know, it's obviously the third segment in the Toy Story trilogy, and at this point, Andy, who's the little boy now, he's grown up, is going away to college. The toys, I can't remember how they get tossed away or thrown away, I think accidentally by the mother. They end up at a sort of a daycare center, and they are they run into these sort of evil toys that are sort of led by Lots of Luck Bear. There's a very sort of strong thread of escape. It's a kind of escape movie, you know, sort of like The Great Escape, a la Steve McQueen. But it's a our reviewer, John Anderson, who I think is a terrific reviewer, talked about the sort of existential dread of the movie. There's a scene, which I thought was terrifying, where the, I don't think this is ruining anything, where the toys are about to be incinerated,
basically. I thought that's where the movie was going to end. I was shocked.
Well, yeah, you better. So I thought that was interesting. I wondered, you know, I saw it with my nephews who were 12 and 5, and I thought, oh, my gosh, I don't know if I want them to see a vision of, you know, the sort of Dante-esque hell. But I also thought I probably was more moved by this movie than any other movie of the year. There's a scene at the end where Andy, I won't give too much away, is sort of reconciling himself, I'll say, to the fact that these toys that have been a part of his life and really a part of, you know, many children's lives and our lives,
the
you
viewers,
know, for the last
yeah.
10, 15 years, you know, he is sort of saying goodbye to them. It's very touching. I mean, I cried during the movie, and I was surprised that a cartoon, after all, a Pixar cartoon, you know, which are very good, had that effect on me. So I don't know if I thought it was the best movie of the year. I am in awe of Pixar. I think what I like about Pixar the best is not so much their technical expertise, you know, which has been, you know, sort of touted, but the sort of emotional heft of the stories. And it's something you know, I think I mean, I cared more about these characters than I did, some of the other characters in the movies we were talking about.
I would agree that I thought it was a really well, really, really well done movie. And I would also agree that it is gets to very dark places in that incinerator. It is really a scene from hell. It's a Dante-esque scene. And, you know, when you were saying, I of course, loved all the Toy Story movies. And I don't know if I'd want to rank. Actually, I might think that number two was my favorite Toy Story movie so far of the three. But when you were saying that, Jim, about and not to give away too much, but I guess this really isn't. This is more really the beautiful message for me when you were when you're talking about Toy Story and just the whole arc of the series, so to speak. These toys have life because they are loved, and they are loved. They are come alive in some ways
right.
because they are loved. Mm-hmm. And when Andy's going away to college, and then especially in number two, there's this thing between a collector can have something and
right.
keep it on a shelf. A toy is meant to be played with and lived. It is not meant to be looked at simply. And I think there's something beautiful about that. It's used. It's stuff that it's relational. It's
also
like,
this notion, I think, you know, one of the reasons I think it might have appealed to older viewers, probably parents and whatnot, uncles and aunts as well, is that, you know, you have this kid who is, you know, apparently like 16, 17 going off to college. And where most kids of that age, you know, in a sense, close the door on their childhood, and I think most young adults do, it's not until you become sometimes, you know, 30, 40, 50, that you sort of open that door up again and you say, you know, that was a really valuable time in my life.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. And to see a kid do this, even though a cartoon kid, was very touching. You get the sense he is a mature person, you know.
You're right. No, it's right.
And then to have it speak to, you know, adults in the audience who may be just opening that door up themselves and seeing how valuable their childhood was and what a grace it was, you know. And
yes.
It was very touching.
I thought so too. I mean, just those final scenes where obviously it's acting as sort of a metaphor for kind of any of life's transition points. You know, this moment where you leave home. And, you know, whether, you know, you're talking about his toys here, but, you know, in many ways it could be about his relationship with his friends, with his parents, you know, and like right. having to move on at that point in life and realize that, you know, even some of your most loving relationships are, you know, bound to end at some point. And that's, you know, it's a dark territory, but it is, as you said, it has this real emotional depth.
Interestingly, I read a review. I think maybe John Anderson said this, that not only do we know these characters on screen, but because the movie's been around for so long, kids actually have grown up with, you know,
with
Buzz,
these actual
Buzz
toys.
Lightyear
yeah.
and Woody toys, and so they are actually doing the same thing
that's
that this Andy
true.
Is doing, which was fascinating.
No, you're very
triumph
very
of marketing.
Right.
That's and Jim, that insight about the notion, you're right, because, I mean, I think there are a number of us who go back and have a love of our toys from childhood, and there can be a camp aspect to that, but there's
sure.
also a beautifully important aspect of that innocence. It's not loss. It's actually a reliving and an
right.
ability to mm-hmm. touch that again. That it's not simply camp. It's very real. And you're right. The character Andy in the movie itself is wise beyond his years to be able to see, to be able to see that.
Right. Well, and you know, to get all Ignatian on you, to quote Pulp Fiction, you know, it's a little bit of, it's like an examination of conscience for him. He is going back and he is reviewing where he experienced God and sort of taking these things out of the box at the end and sort of looking at them, as Ignatius would say, and kind of savoring them and, you know, giving that experience to someone new, you know, which was in a sense, was also very generous, you know, of him. I found it very touching. Wow. I think my 5-year-old nephew had sort of escaped him.
I was going to say, I didn't see it with little kids. What did they think of it?
Oh, they loved it. I think the whole, you know, they see worse on, you know, Halo 3. My 5-year-old nephew likes Destroyed in Seconds, so I don't think the incinerating scene.
Right, there's still some good comedy, and it escape film on another level. So, all right, we've got two more to talk about, so we're going to try to bring this to a close. We've got True Grit, which I have not seen, but... remake of the original, of course, starring John Wayne, and this one from the Coen brothers. Now, Bill, I know you sort of have...
You're the only one that's seen this?
No, I saw it. Okay. I saw it, yeah.
You've had mixed feelings about the Coen brothers in the past, or are you generally a big fan of that?
I have...
I know we've talked about other films.
True Grit, you're right, Tim. I have to admit, the Coen brothers, I see almost everything they do, and my sort of thumbnail take on them is that they are, again, like Christopher Nolan in different ways, very, very proficient, brilliant in some ways filmmakers. I liked the movie last year,
Solitary Man. We talked about that last
beautiful
year.
Beautiful movie. I thought a really powerful movie. But I do say movies before that, like
Fargo.
No Country for Old Men.
Miller's Crossing.
Yeah.
No Country
for Old Men. Well, by the time I got to past Barton Fink, the Big Lebowski.
Big Lebowski.
But I did get to a sense that these guys were so smart, and yet there was a facility to what they do. I never... Ultimately, when I got past Lebowski and the movie, the later movies, I get the feeling there was a real sense of misanthropy to their movies. And ultimately, I think they are far more about their own ability to spin a yarn rather than ever sort of engage me in any level beyond my laughter. And that laughter ultimately can be pretty nihilistic on some level. So my point on them is that I think they're obviously great filmmakers that leave me sort of flat at the end of the day.
Even in True Grit?
No, but the contrast that I thought True Grit was really well done. I think it didn't, you know, deal in the same sort of, you know, like the Coen brothers, like David Mamet, is a guy, they have their own style, very stylized. And so does Quentin Tarantino. They're not the only people in the world. And yet I thought True Grit transcended their style to be a really powerful story.
Well, also they allowed the... I haven't read the book, but I actually was sort of flipping through it in a bookstore the other day, and I'd heard that the language is preserved more or less intact, you know, this great book. And I think that I love the Coen brothers. I think they're great. I do think that they can be, like, you know, Christopher Nolan, a little gimmicky, you know, and a little too kind of experimental.
Okay.
True Grit, they just told the story.
Yeah.
I thought there wasn't a lot of, like, junk going on in the background. It wasn't cutesy. They used the dialogue. I thought the girl, Haley Seinfeld, I guess, was spectacular. I love Jeff Bridges. I think he was terrific. It's amazing that, you know, he's getting old enough to play this, you know, kind of like crusty John Wayne role. Yeah. Someone said this was like the Big Lebowski, you know, in 1870, you know, this kind of slob, basically.
Yeah.
I thought, I was also surprised. It was also visually beautiful. I mean, it reminds me of Fargo in terms of their facility with you know, portraying these great landscapes, you know, these sort of bleak, barren landscapes. Some of the scenes like when they're walking through the woods are terribly beautiful. And I also thought, you know, at the end, there are certain scenes of kind of not only redemption, but kind of self-sacrifice that I was surprised at. I was surprised at how moving that movie was. But it really kept my interest. And also, you know, once again, you know, the Western is supposed to be dead, and you know every time the Western comes back, people say, "Oh, it's resurrected." But I think it's also a sort of iconic portrayal, you know, for Americans, and it really, you know, it did great at the box office as well.
Well, I mean, I don't. Yeah,
I think it beat out. It beat out Social Network. I mean, it's
did it really?
Oh yeah,
The notion I know there's been different waves when the Western is supposedly dead, but it's like saying Greek myth will never be relevant again. Of course, it's going to be relevant again. Mm-hmm. This is what these are. These are stories. These aren't just stories about cowboy boots and spurs. You know, these are stories about man against the nature. You know, sort of stories about am I connected to other people or am I not? And Jeff Bridges' character is clearly somebody who wants no connection with anyone except booze and money.
Right.
And this young woman is I thought it was a really well done story. And I think the Coen brothers are brilliant, but also leave me very blank usually. And I think the last few movies of theirs, maybe there's something in their own artistic sort of growth or changing, they're changing as well, but I just find them far more, and I think it's far more able to sort of engage human beings on a different level that's not simply mocking. And you make a great point about they deal very well with the American wide open spaces. Mm-hmm. Fargo was a movie that I think that sort of originally turned me against them.
Is that right?
I think because I remember thinking this is just really brutally mocking
really
these people. I thought.
Oh,
I thought,
that's interesting.
I have to go back and see.
I thought that is a sweet spot for the Frances McDormand character because I mean at the end she's a good person. You know, there's that great line where she says, you know, all this for a little money. And I just thought, boy, that is a great... I mean, that in a sense, that's a kind of commentary in American culture.
No, you're right. Very ambitious filmmakers, but I think... And good, but I think True Grit was a really, really well done movie.
All right. Well, that's one... as they said, this is one you can take grandma to see. This is one of the few Coen brothers that you can take the whole family to.
That's what they said?
Not the Big Lebowski.
I'm going to let you ask questions of me of this last film, which is Winter's Bone.
Tim, why did you see that movie?
Well, I remember it came out over the summer, and it was a very kind of a dry spell in the cinema, in this country at least, in that there was just very little on the screen. Mm-hmm. And here was an independent film came out of the Sundance Film Festival. I very much liked it. I mean, it's the story, if those not familiar, it takes place in the Ozarks, kind of in Missouri, around the whole meth culture. People who, basically a family whose father is... basically left because he's involved in, you know, he's addicted, but also in the production of meth, and for that reason is kind of on the run for the law. So the story centers around his daughter, who kind of has to try to find him because they're in danger of losing their house. So she's taking care of their two young kids. So she sets out on this journey, and it is kind of this hellish journey because she's encountering people in her family who are very suspicious of outsiders and basically want her to get the heck out of there because they think, you know, her questions could turn up. It's a good mystery. You don't know why they're so defensive. And anyway, I thought this was a story that, you know, you see a lot of films that take place in New York or Chicago or San Francisco.
Right.
Here's a part of the country you see very little about. And one, you know, when you talk about meth, this is a huge problem in this country. So it gave a real window into kind of regional America, which I thought was very good.
Now, this guy, is it John Hawkes? Is that his name, who was Best Supporting Actor?
Yes.
What is he playing? Did you think he was good in it? Do you remember?
Yes, I believe he played her uncle. And yes, he was good. I mean, the cast was all very good. I mean, I thought they were not recognizable faces, which I think in this case helped
better.
Because, you know, they're really trying to inhabit. So I think I heard recently that initially they were all given kind of these new clothes to wear for the movie. And the director said, no, you've got, you know, went to the local people and kind of switched out with their clothes because you got to look the part.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's really haunting because it gives you a sense of, like, you know, frankly, what poverty is like in this country. And rural poverty, something that we think very little about.
Right.
But here are people who are very poor and have to rely on, you know, basically dealing drugs to make a living. It's very sad.
Mm-hmm. Is there a redemptive? I mean, is there something? Is it totally?
No, I don't think it's a totally downer because you've got in essence, it's about this young girl and her struggle to save the family. And in the end, you know, there's a certain amount of hope because you have this younger generation that is trying to kind of emerge from this situation, but also not leave it behind entirely. For example, she has her own debate. She wants to join the army. This is her, at the beginning of the movie, this is kind of, yeah, I mean, that's a sign of, you know, America today for poor people.
Sure.
So sometimes this is the only way out.
Mm-hmm.
And yet at a certain point, she makes the decision she just can't because she's got these two kids that nobody would take care of. So there's an understanding that, I guess, kind of like the fighter, that as much as you kind of like to leave the family behind and just kind of leave poverty behind, some way there's some part of you that's kind of pulling you back.
Yeah,
so
that's a great point.
And does she in fact dance the role of the Black Swan towards the end, or she's successful?
Liz Swan.
It was an unexpected choice.
Very clever.
I would recommend it. So
you do recommend it then?
Oh yeah, very much. Yeah. I would definitely recommend it. I think as I said, I wish more movies were like this that were available for mainstream audiences, just giving you this window and a whole different part of American culture that you just never see before.
At the risk of going on long before we just do a final pick, can we add briefly movies that weren't recognized, I think.
Yeah, sure. Go for it, Bill.
Briefly. Another Year by Mike Leigh.
I haven't seen that.
A great movie. It probably won't be out in a ton of theaters. I love Mike Leigh's movies. Nothing Really Happens, but in a beautiful character-driven way. I just love them. They're very delicate and beautiful movies. So I would recommend everybody to see Another Year. Maybe it's up for a Best Foreign Film. I don't know. It's a British film, I guess. But I thought it was just really beautifully done.
Father Jim, why don't you just end by saying, is it King's Speech you think is going to win?
I think it's definitely going to win. I mean, it's sort of swept all the awards. You know, it's funny. There are these sort of graphs where you see, you know, what's strong and what's falling off. And it seemed like The Social Network was strong.
Yeah.
I think maybe people, you know, were so dazzled by Colin Firth's performance.
Yeah.
It is such a, you know, it's this costume drama. People love that. It's very regal looking. I think, you know, Social Network might be seen as a little too au courant, you know, for some. Because remember, a lot of the Academy voters are not, you know, 20-somethings.
Bill, do you also agree with that?
I would say, yeah. I think, you know, it's funny. I would say my favorite film of the year would, and my choice, you know, it's always tough to pick a film, but I would, because you like films for different reasons. But The King's Speech would be, to me, I think the choice that will be, and I think it's a very good choice. And then I would also agree Natalie Portman probably for Best Actress, although Annette Bening might get that. Mm-hmm. I'd say Colin Firth for Best Actor, Melissa Leo for Best Supporting. And I think if Jeffrey Rush doesn't get it for, I think that's a shame. I forget who else is in that category, but I thought he was great.
Yeah, it's one of those years where they could pick up a whole passel of acting awards for that film. So
he was great.
Once again, you know, all going to the United Kingdom.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Well,
all right, we want to thank everybody for coming along, fourth straight year, and hope to do it again next year. Bill McGarvey, Father Jim Martin.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. Enjoyed it. If there are any of those critics out there, get off our backs. We're doing the best we can.
My pleasure. See you at the movies.
All right, thanks.
See you at the movies. Bye.
I want to thank you again for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. You can see reviews of many of those films we talked about online. We will provide links for those. We also want to thank, as always, Bill McGarvey, who provides music for this show, and this week, of course, was a guest on the program. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.